From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Johanna Fateman and Kathleen Hanna of the band La Tigra. Hanna used to front the band Bikini Kill and is considered one of the founders of the Riot Girl movement, punk music with a feminist attitude. Fateman is an artist and zine writer as well as a musician. Later, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a first novel from Canadian writer Bonnie Bernard, and Lord Schwartz, our classical music critic, reads a poem from his new book, Cairo Traffic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. World leaders are arriving in New York for a United Nations Millennium Summit. Secretary General Kofi Annan called on the participants to consider ways to fight poverty and avoid war in the 21st century. The gathering will be an opportunity for leaders to meet directly on important issues such as the Mideast peace process, AIDS, and regional conflicts in Africa. The summit will also be a forum for protesters. More than 91 demonstrations are scheduled, and streets around the UN have been closed for security reasons. North Korea has called off its visit to the United Nations summit after its delegation was allegedly ordered to undergo a strip search while transferring to an American Airlines flight in Frankfurt. Ann Garrels has more.
Members of the North Korean delegation claim U.S. security officials thoroughly searched even sensitive parts of the body. A senior North Korean official called this an intentional and premeditated plot by the U.S. administration. American Airlines says its staff, not U.S. government officials, conducted a routine security check and deny diplomats were asked to strip. The State Department is seeking information about the incident. It's prompted vitriolic anti-American comments from the North Koreans and ended chances for a meeting between North and South Korean officials at the UN. However, the North Korean delegation says it doesn't blame South Korea, noting relations are improving quite favorably. Ann Garrels, NPR News at the UN.
Hillary Clinton has picked up the endorsement of the Sierra Club in her quest for the New York Senate seat. Both Clinton and her rival, Republican Congressman Rick Lazio, had actively courted the environmental group's endorsement. Melissa Block reports from New York.
Sierra Club National President Dr. Robert Koch said Clinton stands head and shoulders above Lazio on environmental issues ranging from protecting New York's drinking water to cleaning up toxic waste sites. Koch said New Yorkers will be able to count on Clinton in the Senate. With Lazio, he said, we don't have that confidence. The Lazio campaign was quick to point out that the Sierra Club had endorsed Lazio in a previous congressional race and that 2 years ago another group, the League of Conservation Voters, named him as one of its 10 environmental heroes among House candidates. The fact is, said Lazio campaign manager Bill Dal Col in a statement, Mrs. Clinton has no identifiable environmental record. Both Clinton and Lazio sat for extended interviews with the Sierra Club to try to earn the group's endorsement. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
Stock prices were narrowly mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 22 points to close at 11,260. Declines led advances by a slight margin in light trading of 840 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 91 points today. It closed at 4,143. This is NPR News from Washington. Thousands of teachers in Philadelphia, the nation's sixth-largest school district, have voted to authorize a strike. Eric Westervelt reports.
Members of the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers overwhelmingly approved a strike, the union's first since 1981. However, the union did not immediately call for a walkout, so schools could still open this Thursday as scheduled. State law requires the union to give 48 hours notice of any work stoppage. Negotiations over the Labor Day weekend proved fruitless, although talks do continue today. Key areas of disagreement include management's call for an increase in the copayment for health insurance and to start a pay scale system based on performance, not seniority. Pennsylvania's Republican Governor Tom Ridge has said he would consider taking over the financially strapped school district if teachers strike. Under a new state law, the governor can take control of city schools if state officials determine that students aren't being adequately educated or if the school board doesn't produce a valid budget. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Philadelphia.
Cool, rainy weather is helping firefighters in the northern Rockies and allowing officials to reopen millions of acres of parks that were closed to the public because of wildfire danger. In Montana, the Forest Service and Governor Mark Roscoe allowed public access to about 20 million acres in areas that had been closed because of the fires. There are still restrictions on campfires, smoking, and the use of off-road vehicles. Authorities say the huge fires in Montana's Bitterroot Valley appear to be slowing, but 25 big fires are still active in the state. Meanwhile, fire danger has increased in Texas, where officials say 19 large fires are burning. In stocks, the S&P 500 dropped 14 points today. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Noisy guitar bands are often thought of as a boy thing, but not always. For example, there was the Riot Girl movement that started in the early 90s, girl bands with a punk sensibility and a feminist attitude. My two guests were important members of that movement. Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman are now members of the band La Tigra. In the days when Hanna fronted the band Bikini Kill, she was considered one of the founders of the Riot Girl movement. The movement spread through zines as well as music. Johanna Fateman writes zines about music, art, and culture. Hanna does most of the singing in La Tigra. Fateman plays keyboards and does some of the sampling. They both play guitar. The band begins a new tour later this month. From their recent CD, La Tigra, here's a song called What's Your Take on Cassavetes?
We've talked about it in letters, and we've talked about it on the phone. But how you really feel about it, I don't really know.
Kathleen Hanna, Johanna Fateman, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what's your take on Cassavetes. Why don't you tell us how this song came about, particularly the lyric?
Hi, this is Johanna. Well, with what's your take on Cassavetes, it was kind of a series of incidents or coincidences that led to the song. I work at an art gallery, and there was a group show of visual artists sort of grouped together based on the filmmaking practices of Cassavetes. And so I was reading all this stuff about Cassavetes. And meanwhile, Kathleen and Sadie, well, you should tell this part, Kathleen.
This is Kathleen. Sadie and I happened to hook up in Paris, France. It was very glamorous. And we wanted to go see a movie and what was playing but Husbands by Cassavetes. And we went to see it and we just had like all these conversations about, you know, is the misogyny in this movie calling attention to sort of like white middle-class men's like spiritual vacancy and stuff like that? Or is it just being a part of it? Because we both felt really gross after the movie, but we also loved it in this weird way. And we started talking about how many different kinds of art and music we feel that way about, that it's like there's something really icky about it, but we still are attracted to it, and how can you constantly be negotiating that in your mind about everything as a feminist? And so we started writing that song, and then we also wanted to bring up the point of me, Sadie, and Johanna's sort of intellectual friendships with each other, because at the beginning of the song, there's like a girl in a telephone booth, you can hear seagulls and stuff like that in the background, and we've kind of set it up to be a typical, you know, Shangri-La's type thing where, you know, one girl's calling another, you know, and being like, oh, I love that man so much. I'm going to die without him or whatever. And then it's really one woman calling another being like, what do you think about Cassavetes? I really need to know.
Well, I think it's really ambitious to write a song about your ambivalent feelings about a film director, your ambivalent feelings about certain art. It's hard to write a song about that.
Not for us. That's what we talk about all the time.
Well, it's certainly not typical to write a song about that.
I think that's part of what we wanted to do with the song, though, is to overturn that expectation that it was going to be about typical pop song fare of, you know, love relationships or whatever, having a good time at a party or what, I don't know, whatever common themes are. So we wanted to address this idea of, like, what's a critique and what's a participation.
Kathleen, you're considered one of the originators of Riot Grrrl music. I think most artists really hate labels. So let's start with, are you comfortable with that expression?
I'm definitely comfortable with being labeled a feminist artist. Like, I kind of hate the fact that everybody's so freaked out about being labeled. I'm sick of reading it in everybody's interviews. You know, every single interview is like, don't put me in a box. I don't want to be labeled. And it's like, I'm really happy when I see people who are like, I'm a lesbian and I'm really proud of it. You know what I mean? And like, go ahead, label me, because that's something that like gives other people pride and gives other people a feeling of inclusion. So in terms of like feminism, I'm definitely down to say I'm a feminist. Riot Grrrl is a specific branch of feminism, but I wouldn't call myself a Riot Grrrl just because I don't go to meetings anymore.
What was it when you were involved with it, and what was its meaning for you?
It was sort of like, you know, 70s feminist CR groups a lot, with a certain like outreach element of like, you know, doing actions like being involved in protests and stuff like that, and planning benefit shows for like rape crisis shelters, helping out individual women in the sort of punk music scene, skill sharing, stuff like that. It was really, it meant a lot to me. I mean, it was a really exciting time when it started in D.C. just to be a part of these meetings and see these girls who had never been in a room only with women before, you know, saying things that maybe they'd never said, and saying things certainly that I'd never said to anyone.
What would you say has been the impact of that kind of feminism on your music? And do you think it's fair to describe your music as a combination of, say, punk and feminism?
I think that's definitely part of it, and certainly like the most kind of, I don't know, the most easily identifiable aspects of it are, but I think that punk and feminism are more words that apply to kind of our history and like what our references are in our music rather than what we're actually doing right now. I mean, we're certainly still feminists, but I think that we're not so much interested in staying within a confined set of aesthetics that, you know, the idea of punk might imply.
Well, I'm wondering if, you know, having started out with Riot Grrrl music, if you felt that some of that music was appropriated by mainstream groups and by mainstream pop culture, say groups like the Spice Girls or TV shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I don't think the music was ever appropriated, because probably to mainstream listeners it's just too confrontational and unlistenable and has too many cuss words in it. But it definitely, I think certain people who are interested in graphs and charts and marketing saw that bands like Bikini Kill and Bratmobile and now Slater Kinney were making, you know, a living on small independent labels with absolutely like no advertising money, you know? And like, if we're able to do that, they were like, what if we put a whole bunch of money behind something that sort of takes the content out of it, takes the abrasiveness out of it, and yet has this sort of, you know, girl power message or whatever, and put that into the world, we could make a lot of money. And you know, whatever, all the girls rules t-shirts started happening, and we a lot of Riot Grrrls used to write stuff on themselves, you know, like names that were like derogatory towards women, like on our arms or on our stomachs if we were wearing a short top, sort of as a commentary.
Like slut, like you had slut on your stomach.
Yeah, like stuff like that. And it was sort of, part of the original reason was when I started being photographed, I felt like I was silenced by the photograph. You know what I mean? Like, I would get my picture taken and they could write absolutely anything over it, under it, whatever. And now it's kind of depressing because I'm like, oh, I was beating people to the punch. You know what I mean? Like, oh, that's what men are going to think if they see me. And so I'm going to beat them to the punch by writing this and say, I know you're thinking that, which I think was interesting for a minute, but I'm not kind of interested in that thing anymore. Mm-hmm. But the basic point is that then they start having T-shirts that said slut. And who are the people who own these companies? Probably men. Do you know what I mean? Who are making money off of this, like, now pseudo-rebellion. And whatever. I just find it annoying and boring, and I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it. I just kind of keep working. And if there are, like, five-year-old girls who get sort of a feminist-type vibe off of the Spice Girls' girl power, great. You know?
Do you think that the more commercial end of girl power also gave the message of, and if you are really beautiful, really attractive, and dress really well, you can be part of girl power too?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I think so. But I also do think that it's important not to be entirely cynical about the way that Riot Girl aesthetics have entered the mainstream, because, like Kathleen pointed out, it is for a much younger audience generally. I mean, the Spice Girls really is for girls who are too young to do their own record shopping at an independent record store, or who are probably too young to hear some of the content that was in a band like Bikini Kill. Or, you know, it's like, it's kind of apples and oranges at this point. Do you know what I mean? So it's, I don't know.
The music definitely doesn't sound anything like anybody I know was ever making.
I'm wondering if there's certain types of lyrics or performance styles in pop music now that disturb you.
Yes. Yeah, we actually try to shy away from this kind of question because we don't want to give those people any press, because a lot of the jerky guys, and everyone listening knows who they are, you know, who write, like, really, you know, sexist lyrics and stuff, and who just come off like total unsophisticated cavemen. It's like, they don't even deserve our attention.
Yeah, and it's part of their fantasy that they would be gaining our attention and making us angry, when really
we're just not
engaging with that part of culture.
I'm just like, yawn.
My guests are Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. I think for some girls growing up, and this might not be true in every era, it seemed more probable that you'd be the girlfriend of the guy in the band than that you'd be a girl with your own band. What were your thoughts about that? Did you think if you loved pop music that you could have a band of your own, or did you think that you'd be like the girlfriend of?
Well, I was the girlfriend of until I decided to stop doing that. You know, I feel like I would have probably been in a band starting at age 12 or 13 if I would have thought that it was a possibility, but I just didn't. You know, when me and my friend Maureen Gaines took guitar after school in grade school, in like fifth grade, we were the only two girls, and we got like laughed out of the class. We were like so humiliated that we just stopped going.
What were you humiliated for?
Well, like, we would practice extra hard because every time when we went in, like, the guys would just make fun of us constantly and treat us like we were playing it wrong. And I remember it making me feel really crazy. Like, I just couldn't do it right no matter what I did. And there was something, like, genetically wrong with me that made it so that I couldn't play, you know? And then the whole thing as I got older was, like, I was always hanging out with guys in bands. I was always, like, making stickers for their bands, making T-shirts for their bands, like, helping them set up shows, like bringing people to their shows and like going to their practices and hoping that somebody would ask me to sing. And then eventually I was like, I can't wait anymore for somebody to ask me. Like, I just have to do this because it's what I really want to do. But, I mean, I was relatively young. I was like 19 when I was in my first band. But I really do feel like I would have started a lot earlier if there would have been, you know, more encouragement.
Johanna, what about you?
Before I really knew other women in punk bands, I didn't think that that was a possibility for me. I mean, as much as I loved, like, you know, say Cyndi Lauper or whoever, I don't think that I could relate to her in a realistic way. Like, I didn't see myself having a life like hers. So, I mean, I grew up in Berkeley, California, and there were some women in punk bands, and I kind of looked to them and I was like, well, wow, they're totally normal people like me. I could do that too if I wanted to. So I think it kind of took knowing other women in bands for me to feel that way, that I could do it.
Well, that's part of the beauty of punk, you know, is that it, like, you go to the same coffee shops as people. Like, a lot of people in punk rock who are in bands are also setting up shows and working the door and, like, doing all facets. And it's not just, like, there's not the same kind of star system. Although there are people who are better known because they've been in the scene for longer and stuff like that. And there, you know, that whole, like, excitement about being famous or whatever is just about everywhere and you can't really escape it. There is, like, a sort of feeling of being like, oh, I could do that because that person is doing it and they don't have $1 million or, like, a huge label behind them.
Kathleen, having been embarrassed when you were taking guitar lessons and made to think that you just would never get it right, you weren't good enough, how did you overcome that when you started performing?
Well, I didn't play guitar, for one, until now at age 31, and I'm just starting to play in the Tigra. And I don't know how I got over it. I mean, I'm sure a lot of times in Bikini Kill, a false sense of bravado really went a long way for me. I just acted confident and pretended I knew exactly what I was doing, you know, and kept going because I love the spotlight. I love attention. I love singing and having everybody listen to me. Felt really good.
Now, Kathleen, I read, and you can tell me if this is true, that when you were in school, you started a production of Annie.
Yes, that is true. I was Annie. My school couldn't really afford props and sets and stuff, and they also had to have something with a male lead to be fair, I guess. So it was sort of a combination of Annie and Oliver. I don't know how they did it. And then it was like I had a stuffed dog instead of a real dog for Sandy. It's really bad.
So did you have to sing The Sun Will Come Out Tomorrow?
I sure did.
No, that's a really different kind of singing than the singing you're doing on your records now.
Not really. I mean, the thing that's interesting is when I first started out or whatever, everybody said I sounded like polystyrene from X-Ray Specs. And I had never heard her. And then I listened to X-Ray Specs and I was like, oh, it's because we both project. Like, and I learned that uh-huh. from, like, my many years of children's theater. and I always wondered if Polly also had done a little, you know.
Little Annie. Theater in her day?
Yeah.
I thought you meant when you started singing and Annie, people said that you sounded like polystyrene. That was pretty funny.
I wish.
Yeah. I'm going to play something, Kathleen, that you did with the band Bikini Kill early in your music career. And this is called Rebel Girl, and it's considered like one of the anthems of Riot Girl music. And tell us something about writing this song.
Well, I lived in D.C. at the time, and there was just a lot of excitement because women's groups were starting, and there were a lot of bands there. And I don't know, at that point, I didn't feel like I had to write songs. I just felt like I had to reach up into the air and grab them. And this was one of the ones I sort of reached up into the air and grabbed. It was like a scene of people wrote it. I didn't really write it. I just was the person who actually put the pen to the paper.
Okay, this is Rebel Girl, Bikini Kill, featuring my guest, Kathleen Hanna.
Rebel girl, rebel.
That's Rebel Girl from the band Bikini Kill that my guest Kathleen Hanna used to be in. And Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman are my guests. Their new band is called La Tigra. Rebel Girl is a very lo-fi kind of record. And I'm wondering if you want to keep the lo-fi sound or if you want to get more kind of technically, if you want to get better technical audio quality on your recordings now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we always wanted that. It's not a aesthetic as much as it's been a money limitation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like the first Bikini Kill album was done on a 4-track. Well, it's actually half of an album, but it was done on a 4-track for $17. So, you know, we just didn't have any money, and even with the albums, I remember spending $1,000 and like working for a week or something and being really freaked out about how expensive it was. And now I'm finding out about the budgets that regular bands have, and I'm kind of like, wow. You know, and we still, with La Tigra, try to keep the cost down and also keep the control in our own hands by recording a lot of our initial tracks ourselves and doing a lot of pre-production and production in the studio. Because we're really interested in, like, we're interested in taking over everything. I don't want some, you know, guy who's behind the mixing board or whatever, like deciding what our sound is for us. You know, we want to know as much as possible so that we can explain our ideas and in some cases make our ideas happen all on our own.
Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Bonnie Bernard's first novel, and our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reads a poem from his new book. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. Here's a track from their recent CD, La Tigra, in which they pay tribute to a pretty wide assortment of people and bands that have influenced them.
Yeah.
Music from the CD La Tigra. Singer and guitarist Kathleen Hanna used to front the band Bikini Kill, one of the 90s Riot Girl bands that combined a punk sensibility with a feminist attitude. Johanna Fateman of La Tigra writes zines as well as playing music. When she started writing zines in high school, she didn't think of herself as a Riot Girl, although her subject matter was influenced by the movement, and some of her zines were later distributed by the Riot Girl Press. I asked what she wrote about in her early zines.
I guess feminism. I mean, it was sort of more poetic and abstract than, like, necessarily sort of just political ideas, but it was definitely about sexism and growing up and being in high school and being a teenager and feeling extremely alienated and sort of discovering punk music and punk aesthetics and finding a way to rebel and be part of something different than what I saw the majority of my classmates or, you know.
But at the same time, it's like, you're a really theoretical writer. I mean, like, Joe's fanzines aren't like scene reports and like pictures of people in bands. Like,
right.
They're like based in like theory and stuff, and the way that she writes is really challenging. And I think it's important to note that like in the Riot Girl scene, like there wasn't just like new kinds of music being created. There was also new forms of writing, new ways of writing. Like one of the things in Snarla, which was one of Joe's early fanzines that she did, was she had these conversations with different parts of herself.
Mm-hmm.
Were you the one who wrote that stuff?
Yeah.
So, like, she would have, like, you know, conversation with my insomnia. Or what's another one?
I think I had conversation with my migraine, because I had migraine headaches. But they, or what else was there? There was stuff like that. There was stuff like, it wasn't scene reports and pictures of bands. Even though I went to those shows, that wasn't really what I was interested in writing about. So, and there was definitely other girls working on projects in that same vein of kind of visual art or literary things that functioned as like adjacent material to the music that weren't about the music.
You've both talked about the importance of feminism in your life and in your music. How were you exposed to that? And I'm wondering if your mothers were feminists.
My mom's a feminist. Definitely. I mean, I grew up in Berkeley, California, which, you know, is a university town and sort of famous for being a place where, you know, radical politics are talked about. So I feel like I was exposed to radical ideas when I was really young.
I grew up in suburbia, in various suburbias. My family moved a lot. We moved every, like, 3 years. My dad worked for the union, for Local 669, Pipefitters and Welders. And my mom has always been a nurse at various, like, mental health facilities. So, but wherever we lived, we usually, like, you know, lived in townhouses or something in the suburbs. And my mom was kind of, like, a secret feminist. Like, she didn't really, you know, it wasn't like we had, like, any bohemian friends or, you know what I mean? Like, pretty much the books in our house were, like, romance novels and detective novels. But my mom worked in this sort of, like, clandestine domestic violence shelter. And I didn't remember this until a couple years ago. I just remember her kind of sneaking out of the house to this, I think it was, like, an Episcopal church that had a phone, you know, crisis phone line thing in the basement. And she would go there every so often and do that. And she got Ms. Magazine. And she took me to Solidarity Day in D.C. when I was, like, I don't know, 10 or something. And we saw Bella Abzug speak. And we, like, hung out in the feminist group or, like, the feminist groups that were there because people were still interested in, like, you know, ratifying the ERA. And all these women were wearing, like, T-shirts that said, you know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. And stuff like that, and yelling stuff, and I was just caught up in the total frenzy of it as, like, a little kid being like, look at all these women, and it was like the outside world, you know, and the fact that there were all these women banding together and, like, yelling stuff, it just really had an impression on me, and hearing Bella Abzug speak was like, I couldn't believe it. you know, but that was the only thing like that that ever happened.
A lot of girls, when they're preteens, go through this phase of, it's the oh, he's so cute phase, where, like, you listen to music and you're supposed to have, you know, oh, he's so cute fantasies about the guys you're listening to and so on. And I'm wondering if you ever related to music that way. For example, now, you know, like if you see clips of, say, an NSYNC concert, it's almost all preteen girls in the audience and they're kind of screaming and, you know, obviously having all these really important fantasies to them about the guys who are in the band. Did you relate to music that way at all when you were 11, 12, 10?
I was like 6 or something. I was really into Donny Osmond. That was my first concert. And I went and I screened myself totally hoarse. But, you know, I think I really wanted to be Donny. That was the real issue going on. I wasn't like... And I mean, I actually wrote more love letters to Marie than I ever did to Donny, because I was really kind of obsessed with her. But I felt like it was more acceptable to channel my, you know, fake love energy into Donny. But I was also really into Tony DeFranco and the DeFranco family and would imitate his singing style along with the records. So it's kind of interesting because I learned how to sing from a boy who was trying to sing like a girl, you know, like sort of how Ronnie Spector learned from Frankie Lyman.
My guests are Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Kathleen Hanna and Johanna Fateman of the band La Tigra. Do you think about the impact your music and your presence on stage might have for your youngest fans? What it might mean in their lives?
I thought about it once in Italy with Bikini Kill when there were these like 7-year-old girls sitting by the monitors. I just thought, oh, they're going to be in therapy when they're like 35 and there's this girl and her face was all red and she was screaming these crazy things and people were saying she was a man hater and I don't know, was it a dream doctor? But I just think I would really like to have been young and gone to a concert and seen Joe on stage singing and playing keyboards, and I'd really like to go to a concert when I was younger and see me and all my beauty and sexual glory and fabulous singing style on stage. So I get really happy about it. You know, I think that people are pretty incredible and that they don't really need me to become amazing people. But if I'm someone there who reminds them that they're really cool, then that's great.
I'm glad you mentioned your sexual glory. What kind of sexual energy do you want to communicate on stage? Because that's often a really important part of pop music and of concerts.
I'm just like really sexually powerful person in general. Maybe that's a, you know, braggy thing to say, but it's like I get what I want and I have a good time. And it's like I really get annoyed. Well, I got annoyed in Bikini Kill when it was like, it was never women that said this stuff. It was always guys who were like, you know, well, how can you be a feminist because like, you're sexy. And it's like, I'm sexy when I'm eating a veggie burger. You know what I mean? So like, what am I going to do? Like, just turn it off? Am I being really funny, Joe? I have to brag.
No, it's fine. I mean, it's never gone down this road in an interview.
You haven't been to some of the interviews so. Where I've gone down this road. No, but I mean, I think it's like we're all like totally sexual beings, and it's like I really hate the idea that if you're a feminist or something, you're supposed to shut that off because people see that as antithetical to your politics or something, and that's ridiculous.
Now, I want to ask you about another song on the new CD, and this is called Lesson Ray, and the lyric is about two guys who live next door who play rock music and inspire you to be in a band yourself. Who wrote the song?
I did. That would be me, Kathleen, the sexy one.
And Kathleen, is this based on two guys named Les and Ray who really lived next door?
Yeah, that was from when I lived in Laurel, Maryland. And they actually didn't play rock music. They played show tunes, as I recall, and show tune medleys, which I'm very fond of. And I don't know, like a lot of kids, I grew up really scared. A lot of times, like, there is, you know, violence around me. And I sometimes would, like, fantasize about Les and Ray, like, you know, hanging out with them or whatever, because they seemed really in love. And one time, Les took me to the mall to buy a present for my friend. And we had a really good time, and I didn't feel like he was going to put me down or be mean to me or, like, scare me, which my mother never did, but someone else in my life who shall remain nameless did. And I remember just thinking if anything really seriously messed up happened in my house, that they would hear through the wall and that they would come get me. And so I wanted to write something for them, and a lot of times when we play live, I'll talk about it and talk about how, you know, the idea of being political, a lot of people think, oh, you have to, you know, be a part of an organization, which I think is really important and that we should be part of organizations. But there's other ways that people who don't have time or whatever to do that can be really helpful in the world. And one of them is to be that person for kids, you know, like the person who believes them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Kathleen, are you talking about, like, sexual abuse at home or something?
Not necessarily. I'm just talking about, like, adults who, like, put you down. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that can be, you know, the more extreme forms of sexual abuse. That can be, like, psychological abuse. Like, a lot of people grow up with parents and other family members who say, you know, you'll never make anything out of yourself. And, you know, you're fat, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're lazy, you're, you know, whatever. And oftentimes if we're women or other people in marginalized communities, we also get told that by the media, and we get told that by people at school, you know, so it's kind of like all around you. And yeah, I mean, I did experience like fear of violence and stuff. There's always guns in my house. So, I was scared. I'm one of the people who grew up really scared.
I mean, kids usually grow up, I mean, not usually, I guess, but often grow up in heterosexual, with heterosexual couples as their parents. And often that, like, traditional nuclear family is really dysfunctional. But it's also, like, constantly represented as the ideal in media. So just to see, you know, a gay couple, a lesbian couple, or, you know, groups of adults living in some alternative manner to that is really, you know, kind of amazing for a child to see if that option hasn't been exposed to them. As you know, it can kind of give you hope for the future, like, I could create something different for mm-hmm. myself as an adult.
Well, just hearing, you know, people like playing music on the piano together and knowing that they were snuggling probably while they're doing it, like, that wasn't what my family was like at all, you know. So that really made me think there's something else.
Well, Kathleen Hanna, Johanna Fateman, I thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Kathleen and Johanna are in the group Le Tigre, and from the Le Tigre record, this is Les and Ray. music from the band La Tigra. Later this month, they start a new tour. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of Bonnie Bernard's first novel, A Good House. It won the 1999 Giller Prize, which is Canada's most prestigious literary award. It's just been published in the U.S. Maureen says it's one of those tales of ordinary life told with extraordinary precision.
Why is it that I mentally yawn when somebody, even a friend, begins talking about their multi-generational family history? The aunt whose marriage dissolved after 20 years, the step-cousin who was never quite right in the head. But give me those same family sagas in fictional form, and I'll usually devour them. Some of the difference has to do with the clarity and succinctness that writing can impose on a storyteller. And there's also the implicit assurance in fiction that since an author god is in control, there's a design, an ultimate meaning to those stray stories about the relatives. I guess that's all true of A Good House, a novel by Bonnie Bernard that was an award-winning bestseller in Canada last year. But what I most enjoyed about A Good House was that it absolved me of my passivity as a reader. The characters in this novel are so busy, and Bernard describes their mundane busyness in such enticing detail that I felt like I was busy doing something useful too. There are pages and pages here filled up with descriptions of people stripping wallpaper and canning fruit and cooking. The women are always putting together big meals where they scrub potatoes and caramelize carrots and rub roasts. For me, A Good House exerts the same vicarious and virtuous appeal as all those cooking and home improvement shows on PBS. I love to watch as somebody else does all that work. A Good House is set in the small town of Stonebrook, Ontario. It opens in 1949 and stretches all the way to 1997. The story focuses on the Chambers family. Bill, who returns from service in World War II, minus a couple of fingers, and his wife Sylvia, their three kids, Patrick, Paul, and little Daphne, who smashes up her jaw while performing in an amateur neighborhood circus. Her face never looks quite balanced again. Sylvia dies young of cancer, and Bill soon marries Margaret, a plain and wise woman who becomes the heart and conscience of the family. Years pass, thousands of big meals are made and consumed, the adult kids marry, divorce, procreate, mess up and die in unexpected ways, and the town and country around the Chambers clan slowly, subtly change, mostly for the worse. It's probably all more absorbing to read about than to hear about. Bernard was an acclaimed short story writer before she wrote this, her first novel, and she has the poetic precision of language of somebody used to working in a more compact form. Here, for instance, is how she describes the conversation around Sylvia's deathbed, circa 1955. The adults tried to talk about things Sylvia might find interesting. Sandy Koufax and the Brooklyn Dodgers, Lassie, James Dean being killed like that. But everyone listened too politely, too attentively to the speaker. Almost all of them were too unnaturally quick to laugh or offer agreement. Sylvia heard their words not as sentences deliberately formed to tell a person something, but as dull, one-at-a-time thuds against the dull silence that had begun to wall her in. Reading A Good House gave me a sense of déjà vu all over again. The fact that this is a post-World War II family saga, that wife number one dies, leaving her husband to muddle through, and that the author, Bonnie Bernard, was no spring chicken when she began her novel writing career, all reminded me of a novel I always recommend to people who ask for a good story. That's Matters of Chance by another late bloomer, Jeanette Haine. Both are novels you can get lost in, although Matters of Chance is much more inventive and magical than A Good House, which engagingly plods along. It's the difference between the shimmering New York City of the 1950s, where Matters of Chance is largely set, and Stonebrook, Ontario, Canada.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed A Good House by Bonnie Bernard. Coming up, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reads a poem from his new book. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is also an English teacher and a poet. He says he's especially interested in the way we use and misuse language in our everyday speech and the possible revelations that come from that misuse.
A few years ago, I was in an ice cream parlor and ordered a vanilla cone. "Easier said than done," the guy at the counter replied, perhaps with more meaning than he intended. I was reminded of that by an article I just saw in Harper's called "Dubya as a Second Language." It's about the fascinating English spoken by one of our presidential candidates, who's quoted as saying, "He can't have it both ways. He can't take the high horse and then claim the low road." I would almost vote for him just so I could hear him talk. Of course, we're all guilty of this phenomenon. I have a poem that celebrates exactly these kinds of twisted expressions. Proverbs from Purgatory. It was déjà vu all over again. "I know this town like the back of my head. People who live in glass houses are worth two in the bush. One hand scratches the other. A friend in need is worth two in the bush. A bird in the hand makes waste. Life isn't all it's crapped up to be. It's like finding a needle in the eye of the beholder. It's like killing one bird with two stones. My motto in life has always been, get it over with. Two heads are better than none. A rolling stone deserves another. All things wait for those who come. A friend in need deserves another. I trust him as long as I could throw him. He smokes like a fish. He's just a chip off the old tooth. I'll have him eating out of my lap. A friend in need opens a can of worms. Too many cooks spoil the child. An ill wind keeps the doctor away. The wolf at the door keeps the doctor away. People who live in glass houses keep the doctor away. A friend in need shouldn't throw stones. A friend in need washes the other. A friend in need keeps the doctor away. A stitch in time is only skin deep. A verbal agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on. A cat may look like a king. Know which side of the bed your butter is on. Nothing is cut and dried in stone. You can eat more flies with honey than with vinegar. Don't let the cat out of the barn. Let's burn that bridge when we get to it. When you come to a fork in the road, take it. Don't cross your chickens before they hatch. Do not read this sign. Throw discretion to the wolves. After the twig is bent, the barn door is locked. After the barn door is locked, you can come in out of the rain. A friend in need locks the barn door. There's no fool like a friend in need. We've passed a lot of water since then. At least we got home in two pieces. All's well that ends. It ain't over till it's over. There's always one step further down you can go. It's a milestone hanging around my neck. Include me out. It was déjà vu all over again.
Lloyd Schwartz teaches English at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Proverbs from Purgatory appears in Lloyd's new book of poems, Cairo Traffic. It will be published October 1st. Thank you. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. And from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bill Moyers has a new PBS series about dying called On Our Own Terms. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Moyers about the series and about the deaths he's witnessed in his own life. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.